The next case on our calendar, 03-1653, Henry Alkelly and Ferraro asbestos cases. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Donna Carr, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 9th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Carr.
Thank you.
Mr. McCartan.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it please the court, I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Dana Corporation. I will be making the argument for all the appellants. And with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
About your time there.
This case comes to this court following an erroneous effort to deal with one of the difficult dimensions of mass tort litigation. An effort that resulted in the courts below acting in excess of their jurisdiction, and contrary to the clear and controlling terms of a 1999 settlement agreement entered into between the Center for Claims Resolution on behalf of 19 member companies, a law firm representing some 15,000 asbestos claimants in cases pending here in Ohio and in other jurisdictions throughout the country. Having reviewed the briefs, this court may well wonder what case it is you have for review here today. The case as decided by the trial court, the case as decided by the Court of Appeals on different grounds, or the case now argued by the appellees before this court, contrary to the positions taken in the courts below, and which both abandons and contradicts the decision of the Court of Appeals. The first issue that is presented is whether this settlement agreement provides for joint and several liability, an agreement that provides for a settlement in an estimated amount of $120 million. Judgments based on joint and several liability were entered and affirmed below, despite paragraph 13 of the settlement agreement, which provides, and I quote, that each CCR member company shall be liable under this settlement agreement only for its individual share of such payments, as determined under a related producer's agreement.
Now, affirming. Counsel, if I'm having trouble sorting out what control or even knowledge the plaintiffs have over the discrete amount of funds owed by the individual defendants. Isn't that hidden from their view? And if it is, doesn't that allow the defendants the opportunity to shift around the burden when it appears somebody has gone bankrupt?
No, Justice Pfeiffer, the allocation of the shares is done pursuant to the producer's agreement, and that's provided in the settlement agreement.
Yeah, but the plaintiff?
With respect to every defaulting company, the plaintiffs were advised of what share had been allocated to that company. Now also, with respect to the allocation of the shares, the producer's agreement set forth a very clear formula for the contributions of each of the member companies to the settlements. This is set forth in the appendix, supplement at page 31. And if you examine that portion of the producer's agreement, as the plaintiffs could have done in this case, they will see what the precise formula was with respect to the allocation of these shares. So while the amount of the contribution of each of the member companies was not specified in the settlement agreement, the method for determining the precise amount was set forth in the producer's agreement, which is referred to in the settlement agreement. The case in this respect is really no different from Energy Acquisition against Harbor Insurance, a case decided by the District Court for the Western District of Michigan, where there the contribution of the defendants was not known to the plaintiffs. Here the method for determining the contribution was, and in the event of default, the plaintiffs were advised what the contribution or allocated share was of the defaulting or bankrupt company.
Is there any opportunity for the plaintiff to litigate any questions that they have about that?
The plaintiffs could file any action they wished, as they did here, to enforce the settlement agreement, and as they did in the case of GAF. When GAF defaulted here, the plaintiffs on the first, second, and fourth motions to enforce the settlement agreement pursued GAF for its share as allocated by the Center for Claims Resolution,
now this,
even into the point of bankruptcy.
Was the center, I thought I read in the entries, that the center was also asking enforcement of GAF's
for share GAF's against, allocated share
against the other defendants.
That's correct. Right off the bat, when GAF defaulted,
and
their allocated share was, according to the Center for Claims Resolution, something that should be paid to the plaintiffs, and they asked for judgment with respect to that amount on the motion to enforce the settlement agreement.
Which the trial court refused
That's
to do.
That's correct, which the trial court refused to do. Now, Your Honor, affirming the judgments, I should say, the trial court enforcing the settlement agreement, the Court of Appeals recognized that the plain language of the settlement agreement appeared to indicate several liability, but went on to hold that instead of defining the plaintiff's or the defendant's liability to the plaintiffs, it really served only to define the liability of the member companies vis-a-vis themselves. Now, in construing the agreement in this fashion and relying upon the $120 million figure, the estimated dollar value of the settlement, according to the settlement agreement, the Court of Appeals not only departed from the plain language of the settlement agreement, but I think also overlooked how the shares were determined under this agreement. And I think this is critical. These shares were determined under the producer's agreement on a case-by-case, defendant-by-defendant basis. All defendants did not pay a share of every claim settled. That's why paragraph 13 provided that each member's company or each member company's liability would be limited to their individual shares.
Counsel, here's something big picture that's been troubling me as I looked at this case. This looks, for all the world to me, like market share. That's what has been put together by the defendants is the same kind of grid that the pharmaceutical companies used in California and New York in the DES cases, or a formula to sort out, as you point out, each defendant's exposure and that kind of thing. But I thought the asbestos defendants vigorously resisted market share liability in the asbestos cases.
Well, and that's why this agreement is cast much differently than the agreements in any of those cases. The CCR was authorized to act as agent for the member companies only in those cases where they were named as a defendant. And it was only in those cases that they would make an allocation of liability with respect to that company. This is not a case where there is a settlement for a single sum. It is a case where there is a central mechanism for the settlement of thousands upon thousands of individual claims on a case-by-case, defendant-by-defendant basis. It's much different than the market share cases.
Judge Hanna's wrong when he refers, I mean, his orders seem to refer to a specific dollar amount.
That's why we think not only the trial court was wrong here, but the Court of Appeals in affirming that. And I think the proof of the pudding here is that although the Court of Appeals held that the language of paragraph 13 did not negate joint liability, these plaintiffs now admit that if the shares were properly allocated, then, and I quote, most assuredly, it would preclude joint and several liability. Now think for a moment about what that says, what that means. This agreement, as designed, would preclude joint liability and provide only for several liability. So if we are to give effect to the agreement as designed and the shares properly allocated, or the intention of the parties, then we have to conclude by plaintiff's own admission that there is no joint and several liability here.
Counsel, I'm wondering mechanically if you prevail here, is the time up, is the time passed for the plaintiffs to opt to go to court against the individual defendants, that there is that alternative or that election to be made? Is that all gone because they didn't make
that?
No,
not at all, Your Honor. The agreement provides that they will have additional time. The statute would not be told if they should decide to revert to the tort system. But what I want to emphasize at this point is that if you examine the way the shares are allocated, which is not on a market share basis, and I would invite the court's attention to page 31 of the appellant's supplement here, you will see that the shares are allocated only on a case-by-case, defendant-by-defendant basis. That being the case, there was no fair or legitimate basis here in either the language of this agreement or the structure of the related agreement for imposing liability on the member companies in excess of their allocated shares or their tort-based liability. Now, the plaintiff's basic argument here, which I might add was never raised on motions 1 through 6 and then appeared only in the facts statement of their brief in the 8th District Court of Appeals, is that the CCR did not properly allocate the shares. Well, that only comes after the admission that if the shares were properly allocated, the agreement would preclude joint liability. So if you're going to give effect to the intention of the parties here, you have to preclude joint liability.
Doesn't the agreement give them two options? One is to pursue the defaulting party, which they initially did, or the second is to declare the whole contract void and go after everybody. And if we accept the Court of Appeals and give them joint and several liability, why would you put those two options in? What value would they have? Why would anyone ever pursue them?
It would make no sense whatsoever, Justice Stratton. And I think that's why we believe that this contract provides exclusive options and certainly does not permit an alternative option of enforcing the agreement with respect to joint liability against the member companies.
Perhaps that's a
These
question
options
I
would
should
make
ask
no
them.
Sense if the unstated option were available to the plaintiffs. Finally, the plaintiffs really come down to an argument based upon Section F of the producer's agreement, which they say requires non-defaulting companies to pick up the shares of the bankrupt companies. This is directly contrary to the position advanced by the plaintiffs on the 1st, 2nd, 4th, and 6th motions to enforce. This is when they pursued GAF, one of the defaulting companies, for the share allocated to it by the Center for Claims Resolution on motions to enforce the settlement agreement, and then finally pursued GAF in bankruptcy, resolving with the bankruptcy trustee their claim against GAF for its allocated share of liability. I submit that this position is also contrary to Section 3, Paragraph 3 of the producer's agreement that provides when a company's membership in the CCR is terminated, it retains any obligations it incurred prior to termination of its membership in the CCR. Common sense, I think, also requires rejection of this argument. If a new company were to join the CCR, can we really believe that that company, upon reading this agreement, would agree to accept a share of liability for 15,000 cases in which it might not even be named as a defendant? Under plaintiff's theory of Section F, that would be the case, because the shares would have to be readjusted to require the new signatory to assume its share of pre-existing liability. This section applies, as the Court for the Western District of Michigan held in the Kuhn case, only with respect to future settlements and not existing obligations of the companies under this agreement.
Counsel, how is this case, even though it involves a huge amount of money, anything more than an error case in terms of the interpretation of an agreement as to whether or not joint and several is excluded by the agreement?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it presents an issue here that is of far-reaching public importance in how mass tort litigation of this should be properly resolved. When an effort is made through a central mechanism of this kind to resolve individual cases that number in the thousands.
But doesn't it just come down to interpretation of the contract?
Well, it certainly comes down to the interpretation of this agreement.
Yeah.
And we maintain that the Court of Appeals obviously departed not only from the plain language of the agreement, but also the structure of the settlement agreement and the related producers agreement. The entire mechanism was put at risk by the Court of Appeals after acknowledging that the language of the settlement agreement on its face appeared to indicate several liability. But then went on to say that this really was only to define the liability of the member companies vis-a-vis each other. So what the Court of Appeals would have us believe is that the CCR, as the agent for the member companies, in negotiations with the plaintiff, in attempting to arrive at a settlement under this agreement, was negotiating the allocated shares of the liability of the member companies instead of the liability on the part of the member companies to the plaintiffs. That, I submit, is an improper interpretation of paragraph 13.
You've used your time, Mr. McCartan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Fogarty.
May it please the Court. Three expert asbestos trial judges and two Court of Appeals panels correctly decided the two discrete issues in this case. First, following over 160 years of Ohio Supreme Court precedent, contractual liability for a settlement payment is presumed to be joint and several unless individual share allocations are clearly expressed and enforceable by the time of the payment. Here, the amount of the settlement was in fact stated as a single sum of money in exchange for a single release. In defendants accepted the contractual risk that individual share allocations would not be made and clearly expressed in an enforceable manner by the time of payment under the producer agreement.
Counsel, maybe I'll ask you the question I was asking your opposing counsel. If, in fact, this agreement allowed for joint and several liability, what was the value of the clause that gave you the two options? Why would you ever exercise those two options if you could simply get the money from the rest of the defendants?
Your Honor, there clearly in paragraph 13 was a third option, which even the appellants admit. The third option was to bring suit in court against any of the defaulting parties. Since none of the individual shares were determined by the time of the installment payments that were due, all of the defendants were defaulting parties, and therefore, under paragraph 13, there was a right to bring suit against the defaulting parties.
Do you dispute their contention that, although the amount may not be stated, there was a clear formula which you could derive the amount?
There was not a clear formula at all, Your Honor, and if you could see that in the producer agreement itself. In fact, that was the whole GAF dispute. GAF in the first installment, for which, by the way, we did not pursue GAF individually. We pursued GAF jointly and severally along with all of the defaulting parties. That has never changed. That has been the consistent position. But GAF disputed, they said that the formula that CCR picked for their shares was a great Karnak. It was picked out of the air. It was random. It was beyond the scope of enforceability. There was no clear formula that was determined at the time of the installment payment. That was the whole problem here. 160 years ago, in a case called Stage versus Olds, this court held that joint and several liability is presumed when there's a joint obligors unless the individual shares are clearly expressed. That was followed in Wallace versus Jewell, even where the language was, I promise. This court held that was joint and several because there were no individual shares clearly expressed. And Justice Stratton, you explained what clearly expressed meant in the Kostelnik case. It was a case where there was a settlement agreement between a hospital and a doctor for $1.2 million, which they clearly expressed as individual shares. $1.1 million for the doctor, $100,000 for the hospital, with separate releases that were accepted by the plaintiffs and approved by the probate court separately. That is the type of clear expression that this court has determined.
So we have a factual dispute then that we are going to have to look at the record and look at the formula and see if we believe it clearly expresses it, because you say it doesn't and they say it do. Is that correct?
Yes, but the record is very clear, Your Honor, on the first default by GAF. It was clear that there was a disagreement even among the CCR members as to what the proper allocation was. This agreement
says... Well, Counselor, if there's a dispute,
yes,
as to the amount, that's one thing, but a formulation and the means by which you arrive at that amount is a different thing.
But, Your Honor, if for instance, in Kostelnik, the agreement was we will pay $1.2 million by October 1st in the amount that the two defendants agree upon.
Right. That's a sum certain. We're not having that here because the formulation doesn't provide for that. The formulation for the extent of responsibility, monetary amount, as was stated by the appellant, had to do with the individual claims against the individual members of the CCR.
Please understand, because I think there's a misunderstanding as to how that claims process worked. The settlement agreement says, in paragraph 5, you're going to get $10 million every 6 months, so long as you submit sufficient claims that are going to be valid and approved for that amount. That happened here. That's undisputed. But each of those claims is approved for a single amount in the formula that you will see in the schedule that's attached to the schedule. So Willie Ewing would have got a single sum settlement of $7,500 and a single release with all of the defendants' names on it. And that was the bargain he made. If by the time that payment was due, they hadn't determined how to allocate those shares, Ohio law presumes joint and several because there's no clear expression of what the individual shares were. And that's what happened here. Every time one of those installment payments came due, there was no clear expression or determination under the producer agreement as to what the share was. For the first installment, there was an arbitration pending. And to answer Justice Pfeiffer's question, Mr. McCartan, we have no rights under the producer agreement. They've said that in their brief, mm-hmm, under paragraph 10. We can't enforce the producer agreement. We have to wait, in that case, for the arbitration to be determined. But under Ohio law, if they didn't clearly determine what the individual shares were by the time the payment was due, that's a default by all parties. Since one, it was a zero-sum game. If Dana's share wasn't determined for Willie Ewing, he was owed $7,500. And that's Ohio law. Ohio law for 160 years has presumed joint and several unless the individual shares are clearly expressed.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
I have the same question I had for Mr. McCartan, and that is, how does this really differ from the way market share cases are resolved? I mean, the defendants get together and agree on a grid, for example, in the DES cases, where depending on when the woman used the drug and what location she was at, the percentage of allocation is X. And isn't that what went on here, is depending on defendant and where they worked and all of that?
What went on here, Your Honor, is let's take Willie Ewing as an example. He was owed $7,500 under the schedule. When his claim was approved, they had 90 days under the settlement agreement to make a determination under the producer agreement as to how those shares would be allocated. And they would be allocated in Willie Ewing's case depending on his occupation, his work history, his industry, how long he had worked at various places. It was an obligation that could not even be determined until the claim was submitted. And for that reason...
So these companies negotiated it each time as to each defendant rather than agreeing on a preset grid?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's why there was no individual determination under a producer agreement as to what their shares was. It would be like Kostelnik saying we owe you $1.2 million, but we're going to tell you, you know, we can't decide how we're going to break it up.
Where I'm going with that is under market share, the downside for the plaintiff is that the defendants who are gone for whatever reason, can't find them, don't exist, bankrupt, their share is not allocated.
Yeah, but that's the key question in this contract interpretation case. Who bore the risk under this settlement agreement that individual shares could not be allocated under the producer agreement? And it's clear that that risk lie with the defendants. If, because of a bankruptcy stay, they could not allocate the risk of the five of the next six installment payments because of bankruptcy, the bankruptcy stay clearly prohibited them from making any determinations under the settlement agreement how to allocate those shares. That can't be clear, even reasonably debated. That was the risk that they took under the settlement agreement. It would be one single sum unless individual shares were determined under the producer agreement. They weren't determined under the producer agreement. In the first case, because of the GAF dispute that we had no authority over, they stipulated in the trial court that we had no say in how that allocation was made, that that was going to be decided by arbitration, and that we shouldn't have to wait till an arbitration before they were in default of the amount that they admitted was due then. But for then, the five of the six bankruptcies, there was no determination made under the settlement agreement or under the producer agreement. They were stayed from making that. Whose risk is that? That's a risk that they accepted under Ohio law, which presumes joint and several unless individual shares are clearly expressed and determined. They were stayed by law from making those determinations. And I mean, it's clear on those two grounds alone that no individual shares were made under the producer agreement. And therefore, like Kostelnik, like Stage versus Olds, there's a presumption.
So when the consortium was asking Judge Hanna to enforce payment against the other defendants, that was an end run around the stay or an attempt at
Well, the first case, Your Honor, the CCR for the GAF internal dispute, GAF said, the share you allocated to us is Karnak. I mean, you made it up, you overbilled us, and you under allocated your own shares. CCR then moved for arbitration under the producer agreement. They stipulated in the trial court that we have no right to participate in that. And they also argued to Judge Hanna that we shouldn't have to wait till the arbitration's decided. Again, following the rule of law, presumption of joint and several, unless clearly determined and enforceable individual shares, by that time they were in default, and there was no way for us to clearly enforce an individual share of GAF or anyone else. Because under the producer agreement, the only way to do that would be in arbitration. This agreement doesn't say in shares unilaterally allocated by the CCR. It says as determined under the producer agreement. They hadn't determined under the producer agreement for the first one what GAF share was. There's joint and several under 160 years of precedent.
Counselor,
Go ahead.
When this agreement was entered into, was this a secret that there would be an arbitration process within the CCR?
No, Your Honor.
And the plaintiff's counsel knew that this is a resolution.
Yeah, but
it was logical, given the process of the industry, that there was going to be bankruptcies, that and there was going to be issues contemplated that would produce defaults within the management of the dollars allocated to the CCR. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But what they took the risk that they would not be able to allocate individual shares because of their own internal arbitrations. That was a risk they accepted under the express terms and intent of the agreement. They didn't say as unilaterally determined by the CCR, regardless of an arbitration. They hadn't determined shares for that first payment. No individual shares had been determined. And then likewise, when the bankruptcy started, they couldn't determine individual shares. So who accepted that risk in the agreement that was negotiated and under the presumption of joint and several in Ohio law? They accepted that risk.
Mr. Fogarty, could you address the issue then of the plaintiffs who had not filed specific cases against certain of the defendants
Yes, Your Honor.
And the liability then that was adjudicated as against them?
Yes. Please keep in mind that this was a settlement agreement that was approved by the Cuyahoga County Court.
Yes.
Okay, for mass torts. What we're talking about here is, I think, other than 2,000 unidentified people that they've identified out of 15,000, all the cases were in Cuyahoga County. So at most, it applies to a very small number. But what the rule of law is here is that all these appellants come into court and ask for relief, subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the court, ask for affirmative relief. They enter into stipulations on the record before Judge Hanna and ask for a judgment to be entered against GAF. We ask for joint and several. The trial court agrees under these facts it should be joint and several. Then they later raise objections to jurisdiction. Those objections are all waived under Rule 12H, since not only did they submit themselves to the jurisdiction, the case was approved, the settlement was approved by the Cuyahoga County Court, and they waived any jurisdictional arguments. There are three other reasons why no determination of individual shares were made under the producer agreement that I think are important, because when we look at the rule of law of joint and several being presumed unless individual shares are clearly expressed and enforceable at the time of each of these six-month payments. That's what the rule of law is in Ohio. And who was better able to determine those individual shares? That all rested with the defendants. They could have had an expedited arbitration on the first installment within 90 days. They billed their companies 90 days. They could have had an arbitration resolve the individual shares. They didn't. They were in default on the first. And then likewise with the bankruptcies, they were not able, because of the bankruptcy stays, to make any determination under 362A6 of the Bankruptcy Code of individual shares. They could have moved for a lifting of the stay of the bankruptcy by the bankruptcy court to make those allocations. They didn't do that. So no individual share allocations have been made, even today, under the producer agreement, not as unilaterally determined by the CCR. That was not the agreement that was made.
Your red light's been on. You need to sum up, Mr. Fogarty.
Yes. We believe that for 160 years, this court has held that joint and several liability is presumed unless it's clearly expressed and there's an enforceable individual share allocation made by the time the payment is due. That didn't happen here, and we ask that the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. McCartney, you've used your time, but you may start with 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Shares were determined for bankrupt companies. Please consult sealed supplement pages 1790 and 104. GAF, Justice Pfeiffer, was not bankrupt when CCR asked for a judgment enforcing the settlement agreement with respect to it. It did not go into bankruptcy until later. The settlement agreement refers only to an estimated dollar value of the settlement. It is not a total sum settlement. Shares are determined according to the producer's agreement, which, if I may, reads as follows. For each asbestos-related claim in which any participating producer is named as a defendant or a third-party defendant or is otherwise designated in the claim as responsible for the injury, that participating producer's average cost per closed claim in the corresponding occupational grouping will be converted into an individual liability payment share. For each such claim, the liability payment share of each participating producer so named will be the ratio of its average cost per closed claim for that occupational grouping to the sum of the average cost per closed claim for that occupational grouping of all participating producers so named in that particular case. This was a settlement on a case-by-case, defendant-by-defendant basis, according to a formula that was set forth in the agreement, known to plaintiffs at the time the settlement agreement was executed, and which, upon discovery, could have required the CCR to specify in what way the shares were being allocated.
So there was a mathematical formula
exactly.
to be applied that did not, it related, it did not necessarily relate to the nature of the friability of the asbestos in a particular location or those kinds of
no,
things.
No, the shares were determined in the manner as specified here. But I think the important fact here is that it was done on a case-by-case, defendant-by-defendant basis, which is consistent only with several liability and not joint and several liability in this case. There's no presumption here of joint and several liability, because any time there is an agreement that provides that a party will be liable only for its individual share, I suggest that that presumption has to yield to a manifestation of contrary intent, which was certainly the case here in the settlement agreement in the language of paragraph 13, and in the formula set forth in the producer's agreement for the allocation of the shares on a several basis, not a joint basis with respect to each claim.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty.
All right.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.